Today on the 21st Show, nonviolence was key to Martin Luther King's conception of politics, following the example of Gandhi.
I feel that nonviolence, organized, I should say, organized nonviolent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression.
But even before his assassination, other activists in the Black freedom struggle were rejecting parts of that philosophy. Today we're going to talk about how both Gandhi and King approached the subject of nonviolence and consider its relevance today. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And on this Martin Luther King Day, we're going to take a break from the news to consider a few lessons of history related to nonviolent resistance. For Martin Luther King, nonviolence was an essential element of his prosecution of the Black freedom struggle. In an interview from 1957, this after the Little Rock school crisis, King talked about why he was committed to the philosophy.
It seems to me that there are three ways that oppressed people can deal with their oppression.
What are they, Dr. King?
Well, one is to rise up in open violence, in physical violence. And some persons have used that method, persons who have been oppressed. But I think the danger of that method is its futility. I feel that violence creates many more social problems than it solves.
But just as King thought violence was wrong, he also rejected passive acceptance of oppression.
Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
Today, we're going to talk about what Martin Luther King called his pilgrimage to nonviolence, how it related to the foundations of that philosophy as articulated by Gandhi, and how, in both King's time and today, there were those who questioned the effectiveness of nonviolence as a tool of politics. Last year, I talked about this with Karuna Montena. She's a professor of political science at Columbia University in New York and a scholar of Gandhi and King. She wrote a chapter in a book that came out a few years ago called To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King, Jr. The chapter was called Showdown for Nonviolence, The Theory and Practice of Nonviolent Politics. Because our show is on tape today, no calls, but you can always let us know what you thought about our program. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. Professor Montena, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to be with us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Can we start with Gandhi and talk about how he came to the idea of nonviolent direct action?
Sure. There were sort of two origin points. One, Gandhi as a young man was a student studying to be a lawyer in India, in London, from India. And there he ran into, I would say, it was sort of his first entry into thinking about politics or philosophy or moral ideas in any serious way. And it came through a slightly unusual route, at least from our perspective, which was through his contact with the vegetarian movement in London. But the vegetarian movement in London at the time was linked to a wider anti-industrial philosophy and ideas about social inequality, about how industrial living had transformed us. So there were a lot of these Victorian, we'd call them sort of experimenters, radical dissenters, who were interested in criticizing industrial society and thinking of other ways of living, but they were also connected to debates about anti-imperialism, passivism, socialism, anarchism, new kinds of thinking about politics. And the key figurehead that got of those all bringing all those strands together was Leo Tolstoy. So we know Tolstoy as the author, of course, of the great novels, but he was also at that time a kind of a radical, spiritual, moral, political reformer. And Gandhi was very attracted to Tolstoy, and he really became a kind of Tolstoyan and part of this global Tolstoyan movement. And the other idea that Tolstoy was in experimenting with politically was reactivating what he saw as a Christian practice of non-resistance and wanted to find a way to activate that in politics. Again, to work against what they all saw as these the problems of violence in contemporary society. On the one hand, through industrial civilization, and the other, a kind of violent, coercive state that we were all becoming subject to. So that was sort of the origin of the idea. But Gandhi, the real origin as practical politics was when he found himself in South Africa after becoming trained as a lawyer. He found himself working in South Africa for representing Indian migrants, merchants in South Africa. And South Africa in the late 19th century, turn of the century, was really undergoing this transition towards the Union of South Africa, becoming an ever more apartheid society. And it was disenfranchising the local Indian population. And so Gandhi started his first campaign's political activity to defend the rights of migrant Indians in South Africa, who were rapidly losing their civil and political rights and being subject to a new racial regime. So those were the two origins, and they sort of came together as an epiphany for Gandhi as he tried to fight this new discriminatory regime in South Africa. He realized that all of the traditional forms of politics weren't working, you know, organizing petitions, talking to politicians, trying to sway legislators weren't working. And so he came up in this moment with this new technique, which was going to jail, trying to, instead of following these restrictive rules. There was a new registration of Indian migrants, a kind of strict immigration regime, not unlike what we're seeing today, where the South Africans were trying to make residency so precarious in South Africa that Indians would repatriate. And so they imposed a new registration regime with strict asking everyone to re-register. And Gandhi proposed refusing to do this and going to jail for not registering. And he saw that you can connect that to the idea of non-resistance and a new way of doing politics that could maybe change, that chose not armed resistance, but also could be more effective than the channels of liberal politics when they are closed.
What would have been the core elements of nonviolence, practically speaking, from his perspective?
I think in Gandhi developed the practice and the philosophy over time. It started in South Africa, and the key element there was civil disobedience. So it was this conscious collective decision to go to jail. And he thought by going to jail, you dramatized the injustice of this issue and you interrupted the machinery of government. Which is in fact what happened. And the South African government constantly did not know what to do with thousands of people who were willing to go to jail continuously and were willing to sacrifice so much to put their bodies on the line, as King would say. So that was the sort of practical idea initially. Later, Gandhi soon after also expanded his ideas in the practice of Satyagraha, which is his name for nonviolent resistance, to also thinking about modes of what he called non-cooperation. So not just breaking a law and dramatizing that conflict, but also just withdrawing completely on a mass scale from unjust institutions. And this was the first major campaigns against British rule in India in the 1920s. And I think a third component was, so in that way, one component was breaking or interrupting the machinery and government. The other was withdrawing material collaboration or material, the material supports of any government, Gandhi would say, requires citizens to participate, to accept demands, to do what the government asks. So by withdrawing, you're also interrupting the machinery of government, but you're doing something more. You're also withdrawing consent or allegiance, which is the language that Thoreau would have used. And withdrawing allegiance was more psychological. And it was based on the idea that all political regimes, even the most extreme, ultimately can't work if their authority isn't recognized. If people refuse to give them consent and refuse to follow their orders, government will break down. The authority will be brittle. So that's the second idea of nonviolence as a mass social practice or a practice of resistance. And then third, I think coming back to your original citations or the hearing King talk about the three options, the third thing that Gandhi and King shared was that nonviolence was also more effective practically than violence. And so they also, on top of it, had a critique of, as King said, the futility of violence, of the dangerousness and the false presumption we have, our false attraction to thinking that violence, we still carry it, I think, this sense that violence is effective in politics, even if all around us we see very little evidence of efficacy. And so the third element that King and Gandhi would raise is a critique to try to show that nonviolence was practically superior to violence in any sort of project of political transformation.
And I definitely want to come back to that with regard to King in particular. We need to take a break in a few minutes here, but before we do, maybe we can also talk about Gandhi's hierarchy of moral values with regard to nonviolence, violence, and I don't know if cowardice is the right term.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think all of the thinkers and activists proponents of nonviolence have always faced this challenge where when people hear the word, non-resistance, of course, has that term too, they assume it's a passive or quietist or refusal to fight. Gandhi spent all of his life trying to argue that nonviolent direct action wasn't passive. That's why he invented this new term, satyagraha, which means, satya means truth, graha means grasping, because he wanted to find a term that didn't would change people's or change from their usual associations of passive resistance or non-resistance. So so the hierarchy of values was partially for him a set of moral values too. He said, you know, his sense was not only that nonviolence was an active stance; it was a refusal to participate in injustice. But it was also active in the sense that for Gandhi, like as we saw a bit in King too, he thought the problem of what he would call moral slavery. You know, in India, Indians under colonialism were suffering from a kind of acquiescence, but one he thought was one in which they weren't, they lived in a way in which they did not, they lived in fear of authority, and therefore they didn't have a control over their own ideas and practices. So Indians needed to, the first thing they needed to do is become masters of themselves. And cowardice, he meant, was that fear that we live in of authority, and we needed to see ourselves as agents. And he thought in that sort of transformation or overcoming fear, the choice of violence in some ways, you know, taking the example of a soldier, he says in some ways the soldier has overcome, like the nonviolent soldier and the soldier, anyone who chooses to act has overcome that first step of overcoming passivity, overcoming fear of authority. And so in some way, so in that sense, violence is morally superior to cowardice, because cowardice for Gandhi is this refusal to be free, to see yourself as a person. And that was a real moral failure. And then on top of that, of course, so in a very famous essay, The Doctrine of the Sword, Gandhi says, if the choice is between violence or cowardice, I would choose violence. But he will follow that up by saying, but the ultimate choice above, if you have to choose between violence and nonviolence, nonviolence would be superior, because violence he always associated with a kind of weakness, a kind of psychological weakness, that we choose instruments to do for us what we think we can't do ourselves. And he also thought, so there's a kind of dependence. He also thought that when we again think of the soldier, in some ways, yes, the soldier is a figure to, is someone who overcomes fear, and that's something to admire, and sometimes can protect people. But in the way that a normal soldier protects with arms is usually the people that he faces or he or she faces, they are, they stand, they fear this new person. And Gandhi said that the beauty of nonviolence would be, it would be a form of overcoming fear, which also didn't induce fear in everyone else. And there's a Sanskrit term called abedan, which means giving the gift of fearlessness. So he had some idea that the nonviolent soldier not only overcame fear, but also gave this gift of overcoming fear to all those who participated or witnessed that action.
What a powerful phrase, nonviolent soldier. Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to my January interview of Karuna Montana, Columbia University professor and scholar of both Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Our program's on tape today, so no calls, but I do want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We often ask questions of listeners before we go to air, and we can share them with our guests during the broadcast. You can join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. More to come after a break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For the hour today, we are talking about nonviolence, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, how those ideas traveled through time across the world, and how they are still relevant today. My guest is Karuna Montana, professor at Columbia University. She's written extensively and researched extensively on this in books and essays about the politics of Gandhi and nonviolence and King. I want to read now a brief bit from an essay that King wrote called My Pilgrimage to Nonviolence. It appeared in Stride Toward Freedom, about the Montgomery bus boycott. King describes going to see a lecture by a man named Mordecai Johnson, who was the president of Howard University. He says, quote, Dr. Johnson had just returned from a trip to India, and to my great interest, he spoke of the life and teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. His message was so profound and electrifying that I left the meeting and bought a half dozen books on Gandhi's life and works. What do you talk about this? Talk about King's journey to nonviolence. I mean, he described himself as a latecomer to the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that that recounting and that essay really is important, because it shows, I think, two things. One is that when King was a student at Morehouse, at Crozier Theological Seminary, and really more generally the connections he had with African-American theologians, that Gandhi was what I would call a real live reference. He went to school as an undergraduate at Morehouse. His mentor at Morehouse was Benjamin Mays, another African-American theologian who had traveled to India and met with Gandhi and the Gandhian movement. Howard Thurman, who a king will have many times come across, both at Crozier and later in Boston when he's doing his PhD, was one of the most important sort of conduits and origins of African-American nonviolence. Thurman had gone on a trip with the NAACP or the YMCA to India in the 30s, met Gandhi, and they had a very famous meeting where Gandhi had said to Thurman that it may be through the Negroes that the unadulterated message of nonviolence will be given to the world. So I think on the one hand, where King, his interest in theology, in Christian, Gandhi was the first people who came very interested in Gandhi were Christians, and African-American Christians especially were very interested in Gandhi as a figure and also thinking about nonviolence as a potential method to be adopted and used. This also was true across the African-American press, where it was real debates, not just theologians, but political actors trying to think through what lessons Gandhi might be giving. But it's also true that King says that even though he was fascinated with Gandhi, learned about Gandhi, but he wasn't quite true or convinced yet if nonviolence, he hadn't had a deep enough learning or interest to know whether and how it might work. He was still skeptical. That he associated nonviolence with a commitment to peace and love, and he wasn't quite sure that our moral characters all had that capacity. And so the other origin, which I think is important, is he really learned about it in two ways. When he became the accidental leader of the Montgomery bus boycott, he was chosen to be a leader after the boycott movement was organized and set up by others, and he was chosen really because he was young and new and not controversial. But as he sort of found his own stride as becoming the leader, he thought more carefully about nonviolence, and he learned in Montgomery. He met Bayard Rustin, Glenn Smiley, who came to Montgomery from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And the Fellowship of Reconciliation had already been this organization that from the 40s onwards, it's an international pacifist organization that already had been practicing, disseminating Gandhian tactics and techniques. And they also had an offshoot from the 40s called CORE, that was the Congress of Racial Equality, that were, again, trying to figure out how to use tactics and methods. So King was a latecomer, in some ways, because he wasn't as deeply enmeshed either in Gandhian philosophy or Gandhian tactics as some of the other leaders of the civil rights movement, Bayard Rustin, James Lawson, James Farmer. These were figures who, in the case of Rustin, who had been practicing techniques, Gandhian techniques, both in terms of labor activism and war resistance. So there were many streams of not just thinking, but actual experiments in nonviolent tactics in America before Gandhi, and then even as the civil rights movement took off and the bus boycott was this amazingly successful experiment that tossed King and nonviolence to the forefront of the civil rights movements. It was only after the sit-in movements, the student sit-ins, and the freedom rides that were not organized by King, that you also had other really, we might even say the vanguard of the nonviolent techniques and the civil rights movements were these young student movements that were really much more radically willing to put their lives in the face of violence. But King eventually, over time, I think, put all these streams together and really became the spokesman of this movement. Unlike the Gandhian movement, in some ways, the civil rights movement had multiple streams, multiple leaders thinking and working together, sometimes competing with each other to innovate their practices of nonviolence.
Let's talk a little about some of those practices, and or maybe aims is the better term, I guess. You have King citing Gandhi and saying that nonviolence, for example, exposes and attacks systems of evil, not persons. What does that mean?
Well, I think there are sort of there was a couple of innovations that King made to the theory and practice of nonviolence. And he did so in a way through the practice. So as he confronted the specific question of racial oppression, racial domination, and racial potentially reconciliation, I think he had to deal with a couple of questions very came much more to the fore than in Gandhi's case. That idea of, so one of the core elements of nonviolent direct action, as that was sort of the civil rights language, the translation of Satyagraha, was nonviolent direction. And the idea was why it had to be direct action was because all of Gandhi and King thought that there were limits to just basic rational persuasion wasn't going to get you where you need to be. In politics, there is positions of power, and you have to try to undo people's positions of power. But they also thought that if you, and that you have to do through action, but in action, you are staging a story, a moral story. And if you directly attack people, so there, this is what the tactical, I think, argument for why you focus on systems rather than people. At a kind of larger level, Gandhi and King would say, you know, the problem with English rule in India or racial domination is not necessarily that everyone is evil, but there is a structure to domination. And that's the structure that you want to be for people to see and break. But they also thought tactically that meant tactically, if you attack someone personally, he thought it was by nature in political argument, if you attack someone and they take that charge to be personal, they will put up barriers to listening to your claims. And so there was also a kind of a strategic argument about separating systems from persons, and also this tactical argument that in order to get your opponent, or what King would call the public at large, to hear the message of the movement, to see through all of the dust around politics that makes it a kind of one side or two sidedism, we might say, to see through that and see more clearly the issue of justice, then you have to try to lower the temperature of people's natural, psychological, prejudicial, resentful reactions. And when people are attacked personally, they will dig deeper rather than be more open.
Yeah, it's this idea of, in a democratic society, you need to make this moral appeal, right? And do disruption without backlash, I guess, is maybe a way to think of that. Yeah.
So. Yeah. I mean, I think they were more generally, you know, you have to attack the system because it's a structure of domination, but you also have to, in order to do that, you have to get those who are in positions of power who or are implicated to see how they're implicated in order that they'll, start the process of change.
All right, I'm going to take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, it's the 21st show. We're listening back to a program we first broadcast in January last year with Columbia University professor Karuna Mantena. She's a scholar of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and she's researched and written extensively on nonviolent politics. Because our program's on tape, we're not taking calls today, but we did when we first broadcast this. So you'll now hear a call from Lydia in Northern Illinois.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. For me, the process is very clear. And it's actually always there in parables and nursery rhymes. This goes back hundreds of years. The power is always the decider. And I want to reference the Mouse and the Lion, which is a story about a little mouse that happens to be near the lion or tiger or whatever power base, and then was saved. Why? Because that creature happened to have eaten earlier in the day, was not hungry, And the mouse decided to negotiate even then and said, please, please, please let me live, and someday I too will return the favor and I will save you. So the lion was amused and said, of course I'll let you live. And little did the tiger, lion, or whatever power base know that one day it too would be captured, put in a web, and not able to go anywhere. And guess what? What comes along? This little mouse that at one time had negotiated for its life and with its little teeth was able to gnaw away the net and, of course, saved this wonderful lion tiger, you know, from being, you know, captured and killed. This is our parable today. This has been there forever in nursery rhymes in a number of different ways. It is the parable that we need to look at to save ourselves, not only from leaders, but also maybe even from the technology that is now capturing us. If there is a good reason to be saved, they can be negotiated and they will live. Whatever they are, a mouse, a person, a lion, or whatever, we have to go there and we have to deconstruct it and be less emotional and take it to the children to learn this process.
All right. Thank you so much, Lydia, for the call. I appreciate it. Karuna Montana, if you want to respond to that.
Sure. I think the parable, there is something interesting about parables, because I think obviously both Gandhi and King are very influenced by Christian pacifism and Christianity more generally. And of course, Gandhi's also influenced by Buddhist and Hindu parables. And I do think there is one that he often used, which was about the mouse and the cat. And I think this does come back to one of the anxieties people have, that people often assume that, nonviolence is a weapon of the weak, or it's something that you do when you don't have access to power, which is partially true. But Gandhi and King would say part of the strength of nonviolence is that it's universal; everyone can participate in it, and you can actually generate a lot of power through mass nonviolence, you know, that because everyone can participate much more easily than an armed movement. In fact, you can get out many more people to protest than that. It's that transformation of getting more people out that, you know, changes the mouse and the cat. You know, he said, Gandhi would say, a mouse can't just forgive a cat and have that be a powerful move. It's only if you have enough power that forgiveness is something that comes from power. It's a position of strength. And so you have to generate that strength through these practices of nonviolence, of organizing and staging discipline and dignity and showing resilience and showing strength in numbers that people will listen. So I think it's important to think of that activity and the persuasion is not so much about negotiations as trying to find a way to articulate an ideal that a lot more people can gather around, something that they might inspire them to act and change themselves.
The promissory note, one might say, to borrow a phrase. All right, we are going to take another break. When we come back, we'll deal with some of the critiques of nonviolence, including in King's own time, when Black power advocates were worried that nonviolent displays would appear weak to the white majority, maybe even humiliating. We'll talk about that critique and how nonviolence is still relevant today. My guest is Karuna Montana, a professor and scholar of these topics. She's based at Columbia University in New York. We first broadcast this conversation in January last year. If you're enjoying it and think someone else might like to hear it too, please share it with them. You can find a link to this episode at 21stshow.org or on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, YouTube, and Spotify. All right, more to come after a break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today we are talking about Martin Luther King, Gandhi, nonviolence, what it meant when King was active in American politics, and what it still means today. My guest is Karuna Montana, a professor at Columbia University. She's written multiple essays on this subject, including one that I spent a lot of time with before this conversation called Showdown for Nonviolence, The Theory and Practice of Nonviolent Politics. That was in the collection from a few years ago called To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King, Jr. King himself wrote in Ebony Magazine, "I am convinced that for practical as well as moral reasons, nonviolence offers the only road to freedom for my people." But that was not a universally held view. Talk about, if you will, some of the opponents of nonviolence in King's own time.
Yes. I think the most continuing criticism, sort of an ongoing conversation, was between what broadly you could think of as Black nationalism. Malcolm X was a critic, but also in moments saw the overlap between the goals between King, between the civil rights movement and King's understanding. And then later, and maybe more interestingly, within the nonviolent movements and the nonviolent organizations within them that were prominent in the civil rights organizations, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, CORE, these student groups themselves over time, famously Stokely Carmichael, who became Kwame Ture, who was part of SNCC and part of the campaigns in the South, he over time came and was influenced by Malcolm X too. And even within the nonviolent movement, you had a critique of the efficacy of nonviolence. And I think the arguments went along two or three grounds. I mean, one of them was really about whether the one initially was about the goals of what the African freedom struggle was about. But I think here you really see those two movements, the civil rights campaigns and Martin Luther King and Black nationalism, coming together, at least in one sense, that they both thought that the end goal was liberation and also dignity in some form, but they still may have defined those two differently. For Black nationalism, there was a prior interest in a kind of separatism, or at least they were less, they thought that the goal of integration or interracial reconciliation was not the primary goal, whereas King thought liberation and dignity came, what he would call, you get liberation through integration into and in a transformed American democracy. So that was one conflict, of course, beyond the conflict. And then, of course, there was a conflict about methods too, and a worry that nonviolence had over time, or even in the beginning, in the way that it was trying to dramatize discipline and suffering, that those pictures of students or children, in the case of Birmingham, of the 1963 Birmingham campaign, of seeing people get beaten either by vigilante white mobs or by the police. King, in the tradition of nonviolence, what makes those interactions dignified is not the suffering or humiliation, but the idea of seeing people who can resist being provoked and withstand that in a kind of stoicism. And that's a sign of dignity. But others thought just these images were too humiliating. So there was a question about what the content of dignity looked like, what the method was to reactivate dignity as something that has to be, both traditions, King and Black Power, really thought there was a real psychological damage that African Americans had to overcome. They had to find within themselves and overcome psychological senses of inferiority and humiliation. And King thought you did that through nonviolence, and Carmichael and others said you do that, you have to do that by your willingness to take up violence. Yes.
King was worried that there were potentially genocidal implications to Black violence in America.
Yes, I mean, one of his key insights and I think innovations, and what he noted, that the difference between the Gandhian movement and many of the other anti-colonial movements that civil rights leaders, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, were very much inspired by, movements for decolonization in Africa. What King noted was that even though there's a commonality in our moral values with anti-colonialism and decolonization, especially overcoming racial hierarchy on a global scale, in those movements, as in the Gandhian movement, people were struggling against a foreign power. And so whereas the struggle in America was not against a foreign or distant government, but it was with fellow citizens who you had to eventually learn to live and deal with. And also you were a minority. So he said, again, trying to compare national liberation and taking that as your model, as Black nationalists would do, is getting the wrong analogy, because those nonviolence and were majoritarian movements. They were movements of the majority. Whereas in America, King argued that if African Americans took up arms, you have a massive resisting white majority that might be all too willing to take up arms against you. And so in that sense, he thought it was a genocidal proposition to actually believe in armed resistance as the tool. But I think he also recognized, he wanted to show the fantasy of that, but he also realized the appeal wasn't necessarily to actual armed struggle, but it was more the symbolism and the iconography of standing up, which was really attracting, and a kind of celebration sometimes of riots or other forms. But of course, none there was never an active, organized option of armed rebellion.
I can't help but think that there are similar questions to what's being talked about in Israel and Palestine today about those questions of whether it's a colonial power. We only have seven or so minutes left in our time together. Yeah. Can we move forward and talk about how nonviolence is thought of today? And I don't know if you want to tackle it specifically. Mm-hmm. You're at Columbia, which arguably had some of the most scrutinized protests last year. Yeah. I don't know if you want to talk about that or just modern protests in general, but how do they relate to this tradition?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are both, they both come out of it and have inherited so much from especially the later phases of the civil rights movement, when the civil rights movement was also connecting with the anti-Vietnam movement, the students' protests more generally. Obviously, 1968 is a live reference here at Columbia. I think on the one hand, those movements themselves built out of the success of nonviolent activism, but they also started to reject some of the classical features that King and Gandhi were interested in, which was displays of discipline and suffering as crucial to the tactical logic of how you get people to hear and listen. By 68 and onwards, you often get a picture of protest in which it's more important to get media attention. It may be more important to get tons of people to come out, and it's more important to shout the loudest, rather than this more, I think, careful. What Gandhi and King thought nonviolent protest was not just, it did bring out lots of people, but it wasn't just about bringing out lots of people. It was also staging a moral drama that people can hear your message. The idea was always to get people to listen. And I do think that our contemporary movements do have examples of that. You know, often you have in the movement for Black Lives in ACT UP, you had these very powerful moments where people would just have a silent image, you know, the hands up for movement for Black Lives, or the these die-ins where people just lie down on the ground. And some of those, I think, capture that sense that people might listen and hear the message or stop and not have their prejudged responses if you're not shouting in their face in some form. And I think that, so I think those practices have continued, but I don't think people, I don't know how much, and I teach activists, and I teach activists in my classes to think as carefully about how to shape that message to invite and involve people to listen more. I think that's still an issue. And I do think that many of them have rejected, I think they've mistakenly rejected suffering and discipline as religious or moral elements that we don't need to have when we practice nonviolence. Today, we can just use the tactics, get a lot of people, cause a lot of disruption. But again, I think they aren't thinking about what the psychology of political conflict means and what it might mean to try to change people's minds or break through their prejudices.
And I wonder, in our fractured media environment, if it's as possible as it would have been in the time when King could appear on the cover of Time magazine and get the nation's attention. You know, if every cable network and who knows how many online outlets cover these protests in their own way, if you can break through as much today.
Yeah, I think you'd started to see that as a problem. But I think what King said, and I think there are probably two things to think of, at least there's probably three things to think about our contemporary social media environment. One, yes, the sense that there's such hyperpolarization that any protest, you will always have completely different accounts of it. So there's no unified message, and it's hard to control a message. But I think the way Gandhi and King, they were both living in media environments and not media environments that were very open to them, that they would say the protest has to happen primarily on the ground and not in the fight isn't in the media. You are trying to control the message by how you dramatize the protest, how you discipline the message and the actors. But they also thought one of the key elements of nonviolence was showing your capacity to, your willingness to sacrifice, that you are doing something. What Niebuhr, or picking up Reinhold Niebuhr, who King was very influenced by, he said, you know, what you're trying, and Gandhi would certainly say this, what you're trying to show is that even though this is an issue that you have an interest in, it's your issue, the issue has some bearing on justice beyond you. And to show that you are not just doing it for yourselves, but for something beyond you, then you have to be willing to sacrifice. And so King would say a march to show that should be at least 30 days long, or, you know, there's something else that you have to do where it's not just an immediate thing. So I think some of the way of not letting social media capture it is that the debate doesn't happen in social media, but has to be related to some actual material and real practice on the ground, real action. And I think this, is important. I think it is an important feature of our contemporary social media world in which we, and it contributes to polarization, is there is a way in which we think by tweeting something, we are acting. And I think Gandhi was very aware of, and actually it goes all the way back to Thoreau, was also the difference between giving your opinion or dissenting by just stating your opinion or your criticism, the difference between that and acting. And acting means more than just showing disapproval. It again means doing something that is more, trying to actually lay, you know, Thoreau would call it acting in principle. You're trying to show that it's much more important than just an opinion you're giving to the world.
Well, you've given me a lot to think about. I'm returning, just thinking, as you were saying in the end there, that idea of the nonviolent soldier. Karuna Montana, professor at Columbia, what a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time today to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Again, if you want to read more about this, there was a great book that came out a few years ago. It's called To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr. Chapter 4 of that was written by Karuna Montana. It's called Showdown for Nonviolence, The Theory and Practice of Nonviolent Politics. That's all the time we have for our program this Martin Luther King Day. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about what the Illinois General Assembly might get up to in this spring's legislative session. We'll hear from House Speaker Chris Welch, Senate Republican leader John Curran, and state government reporter Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.